the United States versus Krillick. Proceed, please.
Thank you. May it please the court, good morning. My name is Javier Rubenstein, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellants Robert Krillick and the other appellants who seek to have the decision of the district court denying their motion to vacate the consent decree in this case. As this court knows, this case dates back to 1992 when the EPA commenced an enforcement action against the defendants for filling certain wetlands located in Oak Brook Terrace, Illinois. Under the threat of this enforcement action, the parties entered into a consent decree that restricted the defendants' use and enjoyment of their property and that required them also to undertake additional activities and to pay certain fines. That decree is still in force today. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court in Solid Waste Agency versus the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers held that these particular parties, that the U.S. government, in fact, never had regulatory authority over these particular types of waters, isolated waters. Accordingly, basic principles of contract law and of administrative law require that the decree be rescinded and that the parties be restored to their pre-decree position. In Swank, Solid Waste, the Supreme Court held that Section 404 of the Clean Water Act extends only to navigable and fact waters and to waters directly adjacent to navigable waters. The court explained that Congress in the Clean Water Act only meant to exert its power over navigation. Applying the test articulated by the Supreme Court in Solid Waste, it is clear that the waters that are the subject of this case were never within the scope of the Clean Water Act. These waters are entirely intrastate. They are non-navigable. They are not adjacent to any navigable body of open water. They have no natural or surface connection to any navigable body of water. At most, some of the waters on the property flow into a manhole, which in turn feeds into a man-made concrete storm sewer that extends for more than 2,000 feet and ultimately drains into a ditch that during most of the year is completely dry. And thus, during most of the year, these waters have no connection to any other body of water.
What did you stipulate to originally as far as what was, I guess you would say, navigable or these waters of the United States?
The consent decree included a provision where the parties agreed that certain waters located on the property were to be treated as waters of the United States. Others, though, were not to be treated as such.
Now, those others that are not to be treated as such are not in question now. They, I assume, are not in dispute.
There was only one. That is true. Although the scope of the relief that's being sought now extends to the entirety of the decree and all of the waters, and it is true, as you point out, that the decree essentially stipulated that certain waters were to be treated as waters of the United States. However, as this court and the U.S. Supreme Court both have pointed out, if, in fact, the government did not have regulatory authority, did not have jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act in this particular case, the scope of the government's jurisdiction could not be expanded by virtue of the consent decree.
As far as the consent decree, the mitigation or whatever one calls it to, I guess, create either an on-site or off-site wetland, is that what has not been done? Is that the bone of contention as far as what hasn't been completed?
At the time that the solid waste decision was issued, I would say the majority of the remediation work that needed to be done had been done, although there were still several points of disagreement between the defendants and the government as to whether the remediation work that had been done complied with the requirements of the decree.
What about this 3.1 or whatever it is, acres?
I believe that the mitigation wetland had been constructed.
So it was just a dispute about whether it was done properly? Is that why?
And there were other activities that were monitoring, other sorts of monitoring activities. The decree also was still very much operative because the decree itself required that certain restrictive covenants be put into the title of the land that restricted what the defendants could do with that property, and that those covenants were required to continue into perpetuity. And so, ultimately, the key point for purposes of the motion that's been brought is that the decree is still in force today.
Is that the only, if had the all of the remedial efforts been completed and approved by 1998 or whenever the consent decree was destined to expire, and it had in fact expired, and then the Swank decision came down, you would have no claim then, is that correct?
No, we would argue that in that event, Rule 60b-5 would provide for an opportunity for the defendants to come in and to argue to the court that it would be inequitable for the decree to have continuing effect through the restrictive covenants.
It says that it expired, though. I mean, you'd done everything and paid all the money and all that.
Right.
And would that not give you, would you have any basis for going into court then?
Yes. We would argue that under Rule 60b-5, it would be appropriate for the court to vacate the decree on a prospective basis. And the particular point there would be that because the decree required certain restrictive covenants to be put into the title of the property that would restrict what the defendants could do with the property on a going forward basis, that at a minimum then it would be equitable to vacate the decree in terms of its prospective application because the government never had authority to come in and to restrict or to regulate what the defendants could do.
Would that in effect then allow every other entity that had was subjected to this migratory bird rule to have a cause of action?
It would depend again on the question of the jurisdiction accorded under Rule 60b-5. And I would suppose that the answer is potentially yes, although I'm hesitant to give an unequivocal answer there. Certainly in a case like this, where the decree is still in effect and where there is a reservation of jurisdiction clause in the decree itself that allows the district court to monitor the decree and to modify the decree at any time, that in a case such as this, it is still within the jurisdiction of the district court to be able to take into account a change in the law, which the solid waste decision certainly did reflect. And as this court has held in several cases, because the government essentially did not have authority to regulate and did not have authority to enter into or to enforce this decree, that therefore to vacate the decree. As this court pointed out in Bates versus Johnson, if a government does not have authority to accomplish a certain result or to engage in a particular act, the government, and I quote, the government cannot accomplish through a consent decree what it has no power to accomplish, period.
Why is this a change in the law? The position that always was that it had to be waters of the United States, and this is just an interpretation of what that means. You agreed in the stipulation in 92 that these were, maybe I'm not using the magic words, but waters of the United States. So why is this a change in the law?
The change in the law deals with the question of what the term waters of the United States means. It's defined in the Clean Water Act, and it was also defined through a variety of regulations that were promulgated by the EPA and the Army Corps.
Why didn't you litigate that at that time?
Well, the decision had been made to resolve the case through a consent decree, and the fact
and
that...
And why did you consent without litigating that change of law?
Well, at that time, I would argue that there certainly was not any law on the books that would have provided the defendants a viable argument that the EPA had no jurisdiction over any of the waters on this property. And ultimately, though, the fact that it is true that the defendants decided not to litigate those issues and instead to enter into a
It was their decision and not yours.
It was certainly the defendant's decision, as it was the government's decision.
Yeah.
And
well, I don't care about you. I'm not talking about you.
Sure. Right. And it was the defendant's decision to enter into the decree. However, the fact that the parties agreed in the consent decree itself that the government had certain authority or that certain waters were waters of the United States ultimately has no bearing on whether the government, in fact, had that authority or not.
Well, let's suppose hypothetically here. Let's say a bank robbery case. You plead guilty to an indictment in charging a 1992 bank robbery of a federally insured bank. 10 years later, in 2002, the Supreme Court announces that the federal government jurisdiction for federally insured banks only applied to banks that had assets of over $50 million or something like that. And the robbery to which you pled guilty was of a small bank that didn't have that threshold jurisdictional amount. Would you be entitled to, 10 years later, vacate your guilty plea to that charge?
The answer to that question, I think, would depend upon whether the district court had jurisdiction at that time to essentially grant the relief that was sought. I do not know whether and I would not be in a position to be able to address whether a criminal defendant seeking to vacate a plea 10 years after the fact would be able to, whether a court would have jurisdiction to entertain that kind of a request. Here, that jurisdiction clearly does exist because the district court reserved its jurisdiction under the consent decree. And so I think the answer ultimately...
Well, but its jurisdiction was reserved not to decide whether it had authority to act in 92. It was for prospective interpretation and enforcement of the consent decree.
Yeah, paragraph 2 of the decree broadly stated that the court reserved its jurisdiction to modify the decree at any time. And in addition, Rule 60b-5 provided the court with jurisdiction to modify the decree or to vacate the decree on a prospective basis if it became inequitable to continue to enforce the decree. And in RUFO, the Supreme Court said that under Rule 60b-5, all that a defendant needs to present is a significant change in the law and, in addition, a modification that is suitably tailored to that change. And we believe that in this case, both of those factors have been satisfied.
You see, you're into your rebuttal time.
Yep. If the court has no further questions, I'd like to reserve the balance for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Ethan Shankman for the United States. Your Honors, I'd like to begin by focusing on whether the defendants are entitled to relief under Rule 60b-5. As we've argued, that is their only avenue for relief in this case, since they are seeking to vacate the entire decree and to prohibit its enforcement. Two arguments. First is that there has been no change in the law relevant to this decree. Second, even if Swank, the Supreme Court decision, did constitute a change in the law within the meaning of Rule 60b-5, the defendants would still not be entitled to relief. First, as to why there's not been a change in the law relevant to this case. The important fact here, Your Honor, is that in April 1992, while the settlement was being negotiated, this court decided Hoffman Homes 1, first Hoffman Homes decision. And in that case, this court held that isolated wetlands may not be subject to Clean Water Act jurisdiction, both on statutory and Commerce Clause grounds. The defendants then had every opportunity to try to remove any isolated waters from the scope of the consent decree based on Hoffman Homes 1. They took advantage of that opportunity. As the letter in the appendix to our brief shows, the defendants identified those wetlands that were isolated and therefore potentially affected by Hoffman Homes 1, asked for those wetlands to be removed from the scope of the consent decree, and in fact, in paragraph 20A of the consent decree, which is on pages supplemental appendix 7 to 8 of the appellant's brief, every wetland that the defendants identified as being affected by Hoffman Homes 1 was removed from the scope of the consent decree. That was the consent decree as it was lodged in August of 1992. In September of 1992, the month after the proposed consent decree was lodged with the district court, it's true that rehearing was granted in Hoffman Homes, what I'm calling Hoffman Homes 1, the first panel opinion. The first panel opinion was vacated, but the consent decree was not modified. When the consent decree was entered in September of 1992, it retained that carve-out for wetlands that were affected by Hoffman Homes 1, identified by the defendants in paragraph 20A.
Were the remaining ponds or wetlands or whatever you're calling them determined to be, even under what you've referred to in here as Hoffman 1, which was eventually reduced to a concurrence, one judge, were those ponds and wetlands determined to be waters of the United States by that definition under Hoffman 1? In other words, those not subject to, or at least brought under the CWA based on the migratory bird theory.
That was the government's position. Yes.
Well, what about, as far as the consent decree was concerned, were those that were supposedly not excluded, other than these numbers, whatever, W2A, W2B, et cetera, that were taken out, were the rest of them, and by consent, I guess, considered waters of the United States, not due to the migratory bird rule?
For all other wetlands not identified in paragraph 20A, the defendant stipulated that they were waters of the United States in paragraph 17 of the consent decree, and in paragraph 20 of the consent decree, the defendant stipulated that the boundaries of waters of the United States depicted in exhibits 1 and 3 shall bind the parties for the life of this consent decree, unless certain things happen with regard to the wetlands delineation manual, which never happened. So the defendant stipulated that all of the remaining wetlands were waters of the United States.
Now, they claim that as you said, first sentence under duress or something, the threat of enforcement, they entered into this decree. I guess what I would look at in the present day, if given the Swank decision, would the Corps of Engineers, right? Not EPA. Which are you?
The EPA brought this enforcement action.
All right. The EPA is, would they have authority under Swank to claim, so on a clean slate, claim those ponds or whatever as waters of the United States? Or do you think that's a fact question you just don't know the answer to?
Your Honor, in 1992, when the government brought this case, its position, its allegation in the complaint, was that these were waters of the United States, and its position was that it was not affected, that the remaining wetlands were not affected by Hoffman Homes 1. There's been no further factual development, other than what the defendants have put in the record today, 10 years later, in an effort for the first time to litigate facts that they decided not to litigate back in 1992.
Well, that's why the court, I guess, the district court, pretty much assumed, he said, well, just assume they're all isolated. And then he took the stipulation and consent decree as binding.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that was my second argument. My first argument was that there was not a change in the law relevant to this case because at the time the parties negotiated and lodged the consent decree, they all understood the law to be Hoffman Homes 1. Swank certainly does not go beyond Hoffman Homes 1. Second argument is, even if, arguendo, Swank is a relevant change represents a relevant change in the law. The defendants are still not entitled to relief. It's a two-step inquiry under Rule 60b-5. First, was there a change in the law? And then second, even if there was a relevant change in the law, is it equitable for the defendant to continue to be bound by the bargain that they struck back in 1992? And for the following reasons, it is equitable. It would be equitable even if SLANC constitutes a change in the law. First, as the district court held and noted, the defendants stipulated these were waters of the United States in the consent decree, and in so doing, they waived their right to litigate that issue. They waived their right to litigate both the facts, what are the facts surrounding the hydrological connections of these wetlands, and the law. What types of hydrological connections are sufficient for Clean Water Act jurisdiction? And this is critical, Your Honor, is that both of those issues could have been litigated at the time. It's not like there was Supreme Court authority, controlling Supreme Court authority back in 1992, that was contrary to the defendant's positions that they take today. They could have litigated those issues. In fact, at the time they negotiated the consent decree, they had just received a favorable decision from the first Hoffman Homes panel, but they decided not to litigate and instead to settle. And as this court, this is a critical part of our argument, Your Honor, as this court held in the Bell versus Eastman Kodak case, any ground for relief from a final judgment under Rule 60B, and I'm quoting from the Bell case at 214 F3rd, page 801, any ground for setting aside the judgment, quote, must be something that could not have been used to obtain reversal by means of a direct appeal. It must be a ground that they could not have litigated or reasonably litigated at the time, or else they can't use Rule 60B now, 10 years later, to litigate in the first instance. Clearly, these issues were all open to the defendants to litigate back in 1992, but they decided that it was in their best interest to settle the case instead. What did they get? They obviously saved themselves the time and expense of litigating the case, which could very well be significant. Presumably, they were able to obtain a lesser penalty than the government might have obtained against them if this case had been litigated. And they were able to obtain certainty and finality. So they,
as far as, just let me touch on that point, as far as certainty and finality, have they at least in some way attempted to do all this mitigating and to fulfill the consent decree, but the EPA isn't satisfied with the way they did it, or have they just not done it? From your point of view, I mean, I just want to know that factually.
My understanding, Your Honor, is that they have attempted to create that the new wetlands area, but that it's EPA's position that new area does not satisfy the very specific criteria that the defendants agreed to in the consent decree and the documents attached to the consent decree.
Is that the remaining, I guess, failure, or are there others?
My understanding is that's the central one. The penalties have been paid. The stipulated penalties are still in escrow. The restoration, I believe, has been completed. I would have to check with my client to be sure about that, but that's my understanding.
Is there anything in the record that shows this as it was back in the pictures or anything that shows what it looked like back in 92? What wetlands are talking about and that sort of thing?
Your Honor, attached, the only thing that's in the record, other than what the defendant introduced in the year 2002. But if you go back to the original record when this final judgment was entered, there were several maps that were attached to the consent decree.
Are they part of this record, or is that?
Yes.
I guess they are. Okay.
Essentially, to allow the defendants to reopen issues that they chose not to litigate back in 1992, I just make the additional point that it would really reduce the incentive for parties to settle enforcement cases. The United States relies on the ability to settle enforcement cases frequently and to enter into consent decrees. And essentially what the defendants are asking this court to let them do is to enter into a consent decree and then for the entire life of the consent decree, if the law ever becomes more favorable to them, that they should be allowed at that point to start litigating the case. And for obvious reasons, Your Honor, we believe that that would undermine the principles of finality, it would be against the principles behind Rule 60B, and it would undermine the United States and the government's ability in all types of cases to settle enforcement cases and enter into consent decrees. Finally, Your Honor, I just would like to address quickly at the end the point that they're not entitled to relief under paragraph 2 of the consent decree if they're not entitled to relief under Rule 60B. There, I would first point out that this is a standard, this paragraph 2 in the consent decree is a standard provision which just allows the district court to retain jurisdiction to interpret and enforce the decree and to modify it. First, I would argue that they're not just asking for a modification of the decree, they're asking for the entire thing to be vacated. But second, under this court's decision in the Landau case, which we cited in our brief, this court held that for this type of relief, to get relief from a final judgment, the only avenue for relief is under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, in this case, Rule 60B. And as a last point, Your Honor, under paragraph 2, they argue that it was ultra-virus for the government to have entered into the consent decree. Well, Your Honor, that argument has no merit. Back in 1992, the government alleged a prima facie case under the Clean Water Act. It alleged that these wetlands were waters of the United States. And not only that, the defendants agreed to stipulate that they were waters of the United States. Certainly under those circumstances, it was not ultra-virus for the government to enter into a consent decree to settle the case. Even if now, 10 years later, the defendants believe that if they had litigated the case, they would have won on the merits. Even if we held a hearing now, and it's true that the defendants would win on the merits, it doesn't mean that what the government did back in 1992 was ultra-virus. The government does that. That's what happens every time the government decides to settle an enforcement case and enter into a consent decree before any evidence is produced or any facts are developed. Your Honor, for all of these reasons, the only possible avenue for relief is Rule 60B-5. As I think the other side has conceded, that would only entitle them to prospective relief in any event. But as I've demonstrated, Swank does not represent a significant change in the law for this case, because the consent decree in this case was negotiated with the understanding that Hoffman Homes 1 was the law. Even if Swank is a significant change in the law, it is still equitable to hold the defendants to the terms of the bargain. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, I'd like to begin by addressing counsel's argument concerning the significance of Hoffman Homes. Hoffman Homes was significantly different than the holding in Swank. And the reason is that what this court held in Hoffman 1 was that the jurisdiction did not extend to completely hydrologically isolated waters. In other words, it only applied to waters that had no hydrological connection whatsoever to any other body of water. The holding in Swank was significantly broader than that and extended not only to waters that had no hydrological connection, but it also covered waters that did have a hydrological connection but which were not navigable in fact or were not directly adjacent to navigable in fact waters. Cases like Rice versus Harkin, decided by the Fifth Circuit, or by U.S. versus Rapinos, or U.S. versus New Dunn, they were all cases that involved a hydrological connection between the waters at issue and navigable, in fact, waters. However, the court...
Hoffman, those were completely isolated.
Completely isolated waters. And in fact, if you look at
is that all you consented to, were the ones that were completely isolated?
Exactly right.
What is the connection on the others?
On the others, the connection...
You talk about this manhole?
Exactly. The manhole, the concrete storm sewer, which then proceeds for several thousand feet and ultimately goes into a ditch.
That's a fact that has not been examined by the courts one way or the other.
It was examined by the district court. The district court invited the government to present a factual position on the question of whether these waters, in fact, were isolated under Swank. We presented an uncontradicted expert affidavit that explained exactly why they were isolated and that there was no connection between these wetlands, no significant nexus between these wetlands and any navigable body of water. The government presented nothing in that regard. I think it's significant that, based on Hoffman 1, the parties only excluded a very small percentage of the waters that were on the property. And if one looks at the maps, one will see that the waters that were excluded were the ones that had no hydrological connection at all to any other bodies of water. Swank reached a much broader result and excludes all of these waters.
Didn't the consent decree have some language in it that they were excluding certain waters?
Correct.
Secondly, beyond that, doesn't this suggest that the consent decree did not include any waters that were subject to the regulation based solely on their use as habitats by migratory birds?
That's correct. But what the decree did do was include waters that were not directly adjacent to any navigable waters or that were navigable themselves and that thus are beyond the scope of federal jurisdiction under Swank. And therefore, Swank does represent a very significant and relevant change in the law, even if one considers Hoffman 1 as being the point, the measuring stick for whether that change occurred.
So does this language interfere with your argument?
Ultimately, no, because it's our view that the reason that we are seeking to vacate the decree is because the government had no authority to regulate under Swank. And whatever the parties may have agreed to in the decree has no bearing on whether the court, in fact, whether the EPA had that jurisdiction. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. The court will take it under advisement.